This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. From ADHD to autism and Tourette's to depression, mental illness is a problem many young people face. It's often difficult for their parents to recognize the condition right away, and then there are decisions to be made about how to treat and cope with it. This afternoon, we'll talk about mental illness in children. Joining me are Lindner Center of Hope staff psychiatrist Dr. Leah Casuto, clinical director of psychiatry at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center Dr. Michael Sorter, and director of mental health for the Children's Home of Cincinnati Debbie Gingrich. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk at wvxu.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks so much for coming in today. The place I'd like to start is to really identify how serious a problem mental illness is for children. How many kids are affected? Dr. Sorter, we'll start with you.
First of all, it's a pleasure to be here with you today and be able to talk about these very important subjects, subject matter. First of all, mental health problems are very significant in our population. If we think about young people in general, about 25% have a diagnosable mental health condition, and about 10% are actually disabled by that condition. So really, we're talking about 1 out of 10 children who have a significant mental health problem that impairs their functioning in one of their major areas, whether it's social functioning, academic functioning, or functioning in a family. So this is something that really challenges many families throughout our region and the nation. And why it's so important to have, I think, venues like this is really to make people aware that this is a tremendous area of shortage of providers, and that we really have to work together as a community to help ensure the best mental health we can for our young people. And it's going to take a lot of work and effort really across not only medicine, but also social services and in school functioning. And so we need to work together to put together the best programs we can to help these children succeed.
What types of problems are, I shouldn't even say that word, but what types of issues, what types of disease are we talking about? I mentioned a few there in the open, but what are the biggest cases that you see? Debbie?
I think the Children's Home serves over 2,500 children in mental health treatment annually. And some of the common concerns that we see, especially for children in our school-based population, is troubles academically. They often are having ADHD symptoms that interfere with their schoolwork. We also see an underlying problem of childhood trauma. A lot of the children that we work with have experienced neighborhood violence, sometimes domestic violence or other stressors that really lead to challenges day to day.
Dr. Sorter? I'm sorry, Dr. Casuto?
Well, at the Lindner Center of Hope, we see a lot of children and adolescents with anxiety disorders, eating disorders, depression, also at times schizophrenia, ADHD, stress-related problems, other kinds of psychotic problems. Depression is quite common in adolescents. About 5% of kids can develop depression. And so that's one of the things that we focus in our outpatient clinics very commonly on.
You know, when we talk about this affecting children, it sort of runs the gamut from age 2 or 3 all the way up to 17 or 18 when they become an adult. What do you find? Let's start with younger children. Are there differences in the types of conditions that people have if they're, 5 versus if they're 16?
Yes, very much so. For younger children, that's often the time we're really being able to detect developmental problems. So autism spectrum disorders would be a good example. Those are often picked up by pediatricians or educators, oftentimes at a very early age. And it's very important to detect them early because then interventions can be made that really do change the course and the outcome for those young people. Another example would be in adolescence. That would be oftentimes the early onset of perhaps a psychotic disorder, such as early signs of schizophrenia. It's very, very rare to see that in someone under 10 or 12. It does happen, but it's very rare. Much more it's typical of an onset in late adolescence. Also, depression numbers, even though depression can be found throughout the whole lifespan, it's much more common in adolescence than, and more easy to detect at that age. So we oftentimes see the onset of illness differ between young children and that of adolescents.
Yeah, I'd agree with Dr. Sorter. Another point would be that at school age, we often first see kids with ADHD and learning disabilities, anxiety disorders, separation anxiety. So in part, you know, the presentation is related to their involvement with the school and the referral comes from the school.
You mentioned the anxiety disorder, separation disorder, these sorts of things. How do you know if it's a serious problem or if it's just someone going into kindergarten that spent time at home with mom for 5 years and is a little apprehensive about it? What's the difference between what would be common for all kids versus a serious mental situation, mental disorder?
I think you see when you know it's a significant cause for concern, that it's not a anticipated stress reaction that goes away over time, that this becomes really a pervasive problem. So it's not just the first few days of school and the child's having trouble adjusting. I think that we would all agree that's fairly common. But when you see it be an ongoing, pervasive kind of chronic problem that's really causing problems interfering in the functioning. So like Dr. Sorter mentioned, kind of functioning areas where it's impacting. So, if, you know, over the course of the whole first month of school, this child is having significant stress, having trouble getting out the door in the morning, and this is impacting the school performance and the family life at home, I think then, you know, maybe this is something I need to be a little more concerned about.
Dr. Sorter?
Yeah, I think that's very much the case, is that we really look at functional status. And we think of young people are really needing to function in three major areas, whether that's academic, whether it's functioning in a family, or functioning in an appropriate social pattern that leads to growth. And when you see, let's say, separation anxiety problems lead to long absences at school, or such anxiety in the school they really can't participate in the academic programming, or that you see a family really change their functioning and how to handle this child, because oftentimes parents do everything they can to facilitate their young person to be successful. And sometimes you see very unusual patterns of how parents are really trying so hard to get their son or daughter to be able to participate the way they should. So it's not just a transient, short-lived, minor disruption. We're talking about disruptions that last.
Our phone number, if you have a question or a comment, is 513-419-7100. We've talked a lot about ADHD, and John's calling in from Cleves and has a comment about that. Hi, John.
Hello. I'd just like to say that I'm 17, and I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was around in second grade. I've been medicated since, not all the time though. I don't really think of ADHD or ADD as a disability or
a mental illness.
Yeah. And I was wondering if you could touch upon that. And I was wondering also if, in most cases of ADD and ADHD, does medication do the benefits outweigh the
side effects, maybe?
Yeah, the side effects of the medication.
Sure. Dr. Casuto?
I wanted to mention that ADHD is a syndrome, and when we have the diagnosis properly made, the response rates to medications are quite high. You know, 85 to 95% of kids, when they actually do have ADHD, do respond to medications. There's other kinds of interventions, you know, that are helpful, behavioral interventions, helping them be more structured, school interventions, helping them have preferential seating, simplified coursework sometimes. So all those things are helpful. I'm not sure if I answered your question. Is it John?
Mm-hmm. It is John. I think John also was asking about do the side effects of the drugs, do the benefit of the drugs outweigh the side effects? Maybe you can address that, Dr. Sorter.
Yes, that has to be an individual basis. For the most people, the benefits far outweigh the potential side effects. And this is where it's so important to work with your physician or nurse practitioner or other healthcare provider to really discuss this openly. But for most individuals, when monitored well, these things have a very beneficial effect. And this has been shown in many studies. These are some of the most studied drugs in medicine. And the outcome in these studies is usually the same. You'd use them properly, They work well. Side effects can be minimized, but there are exceptions. And there are some young people that don't do so well on these medicines, and we need to find other alternatives.
John, what do you think? Have the side effects been a detriment to you, or do you think the taking the medicine has been more helpful?
Honestly, I do think the medicine helps me. It helps me. I mean, it ruins my appetite sometimes. I don't like eating. That really affects me. But other than that, it's pretty good.
Thank you so much for calling, John. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our number is 513-419-7100. If you have a question or a comment, as we talk today about mental illness in children, we've talked about ADHD, about depression, and the varying types of issues that people deal with, children deal with over various stages of childhood. What about things, you talked about autism, Tourette's is another one that we hear a lot about. Do you find that is a concern for many young people?
Tourette's syndrome is not as common as ADHD, but it can be very significant. The other thing that's important to realize about Tourette's is frequently there's a lot of comorbidities. If we look at most children with Tourette's also have elements of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. They also may have elements of obsessive compulsive disorder. So Tourette's is oftentimes an outward sign of someone who may have other difficulties. Tourette's has a whole variety of presentations, some that is very mild and dissipates as someone advances into adolescence. There's other people that have more severe tics, both vocal or motor, meaning either physical movement or things that they say or sounds that they make, that can be quite detrimental to development. But it's important that someone with Tourette's get a full assessment, see what comorbidities are there. And there's many positive treatment options for Tourette syndrome.
We'll talk about all of those in just a moment. We're talking today about mental illness in children, how to recognize and treat it. We'll continue our discussion and take your questions and comments in just a moment. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking about mental illness in children. My guests are Lindner Center of Hope staff psychiatrist Dr. Leah Casuto, clinical director of psychiatry at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center Dr. Michael Sorter, and director of mental health for the Children's Home of Cincinnati Debbie Gingrich. You can join the discussion by calling us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We were talking about Tourette's, and we'll go to the phones now and talk with Lori, who's calling in from Dayton, who has some thoughts about treating people with Tourette's. Hi, Lori.
Hi there.
What's your comment?
Well, my daughter was diagnosed with Tourette's when she was 4 years old, and she's now 25. And back then, the treatment options were pretty much medication, and after looking at our options and the side effects, we decided to go in a totally different direction. And what we did was actually treat with diet and supplements. We radically changed her diet. We eliminated all food chemicals, processed foods, sugar, flour, that kind of thing out of her diet. We emphasized proteins and beneficial fats. We used some nutritional supplements, and quite frankly, the changes in her nervous system was quite remarkable. And I'm curious as to why because I don't consider her Tourette's and the resulting behaviors and issues that we saw in school and that kind of thing, I don't consider that a mental illness. I consider it more biological in nature. And I'm wondering why we don't address it that way, because there's been studies that show when we clean up diets, so to speak, and put beneficial fats like omega-3s and that kind of thing in there, that we can see some changes in the nervous system and the brain. And I guess I mean, I'm curious as to why this isn't an area that seems to be routinely covered.
Dr. Sorter, do you use that at all? Are you looking at the diet when you treat?
Well, I think there's the questions by the caller, I think, are very important ones. The issues regarding diet have been tried in many different mental health disorders. The problem is there's been no science that's been able to replicate their effect. There's a lot of work done on dyes and sugar, let's say an attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and they really were not found to have any effect. Part of the issue that we've struggled with in our field is really to see, do the dietary changes that there are a group of people who feel it makes major differences, but we haven't been able to document that really in a standard scientific study that they really do have a true effect. And I think that's really through a wide range of disorders. I think the other part the caller made up was and this actually was from an earlier caller, is this issue about mental illness. I think this really gets to this idea of there's a lot of stigma around mental illness. When we're talking clinically about a mental health disorder, and maybe that's a better term to use, these are many of them, the more we understand, are biological processes. And that ranges from Tourette's syndrome, it's a biologic process. Depression has many elements of a biologic process. Schizophrenia, very clearly, is a developmental problem that has underlying biologic underpinnings. And the same is true with autism. So many of the things that we're talking about really do have biological difficulties that cause the illness and many times biological interventions that help improve it.
Debbie, do you find any of this with the children you deal with?
Yeah, I think Dr. Sorter is making a really good point about the biology of many of these disorders. And I do think that there is some, and I don't know if this goes back to the old days of the schizophrenic-genic mother, and that's where we get some of this residual stigma that, you know, people say, oh, it's trying to blame the environment or blame the parents. And I really do think that's a disservice. We do recognize that many of these disorders are biologically based. As Dr. Sorter mentioned, I don't think there's really good evidence, and maybe some of the studies are newer about the diet and the food dyes. I know many parents who would swear to me up and down that sugar causes hyperactivity in their children. But unfortunately, we just have not found that to be true.
Would it be correct to say, though, that if a person like Lori, who has found that by altering the diet they're having success, that they should go forth with it as long as it's still nutritionally solid? I mean, would you ever discourage that, Dr. Casuto?
Well, one complication, particularly in tic disorders, is these disorders tend to be very intermittent. And so you have it wax, the illness and the symptoms wax and wane. So you can't make a lot of judgments necessarily about what's helpful, what's not helpful in the diet. It's very complicated. That's why we have placebo-controlled trials, double-blinded, with the investigators not knowing, you know, whether the patient's on medication or not, to truly know whether the medications are helpful or not.
Lori, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Again, our phone number is 513-419-7100. We go now to Susan from Cincinnati. Hi, Susan.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My son is 2 years old, and I have been diagnosed with depression and anxiety, and his father is an alcoholic, and I understand that addiction is now being considered a mental illness. I don't know if I'm correct about that.
They're shaking their heads yes, so yes.
Okay. So obviously my concern is heredity and whether there are things that I can do proactively or signs that I should look for as he starts to get older to kind of try and avoid similar problems for him.
Do you find that heredity plays a role? Debbie?
I think we do know that there is a biologic predisposition to certain types of disorders, but that doesn't mean that biology determines our fate necessarily. And I think the caller raised a really good question. And the most important thing that you can do for your child is taking care of yourself. So if you're recognizing that you're having symptoms of depression, that the number one thing you can do to help support him is really taking care of yourself and making sure that you get the necessary support.
We have a thank you very much, Susan. Is there anything else you'd like to ask?
No, that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We have a comment from Anthony who says he's taking depression medicine now and his son is taking medicine for bipolar. And he wants to know if they are related in any way. Are those two diseases related? Dr. Sorter?
Actually, we do see many families that have mood disorders in general. And some of those can be bipolar in nature or unipolar depression, major depression. So to have family members who may suffer with one or the other is not uncommon.
We go now to Janice from Finneytown. If you want to join us, 513-419-7100. Hi, Janice.
Hi. Let's see. My grandson was hospitalized from age 14 to 16 with six serious suicide attempts. He was in the aftercare out at the College Hill campus. He was in Children's Hospital each time. He was at the College Hill campus about three times, I think. And he was in intensive care a couple of times. And I'm just wondering, and he finally completed suicide when he was 18. January 2012. I'm wondering what kind of follow-up I would think. I tried to get follow-up for him. And what kind of follow-up is Children's Hospital doing for children who are suicidal, and especially with that many attempts? I mean, that's a serious case. And another question I had
let's get to the first one. Okay. Dr. Sorter, can you follow up about children's there?
Sure. I think the caller is actually pointing out, first of all, my sympathies for your loss. Loss of a child at such an early age, and it's a tragedy. It's tragedy not only for the family and the individual, but our entire community. And these are things that we really do need to pay attention to. I think the issue of follow-up is still something that we as a community are struggling with. Even though I think Cincinnati in many ways is probably farther along than many of our sister cities in the Midwest, I think we have an excellent community mental health system. We have one of the most developed hospital systems in the nation in regards to child and adolescent care. But it doesn't mean that there's not gaps. And there are many gaps in outpatient follow-up in regards to intensive services that need to really occur for kids that really are oftentimes delayed. And we all need to work harder to really bring those resources to bear on the children who most severely need it. So I think having active community involvement, advocacy, focusing other disciplines that these are important matters is all very important, because it's going to really take all of us working together to really provide the level of services that we can to really try to minimize the risk of such a tragic outcome.
Janice, you had a second question?
Yeah, I had one other thing. I had read the book by Thomas Joyner, on why people kill themselves or why people commit suicide. And later in the book, he talks about a serotonin imbalance in genetics regarding suicide. Can you comment on that? Maybe 5 or 10 years since he's written that book. Is there any updated information on that?
Dr. Casuto, do you know?
Well, I know there's been some studies where there were serotonergic abnormalities in the CSF of people who committed suicide. And so I'm not sure if Dr. Joyner was drawing conclusions from that data. But there probably are some risk factors related to heritability that way. I mean, some of the things we know that put kids at risk of suicide is certainly mental health problems that go undiagnosed. And so, we think that over 90% of people who commit suicide probably had an underlying diagnosis of a major mental health issue that wasn't diagnosed. You know, certainly we know that kids who have attempted suicide are the ones that are most at risk. And so it's very essential that if a child has ever attempted suicide, that we make sure that they get a proper follow-up.
Janice, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. Dr. Sorter, you wanted to add something there?
Well, I think the points that Dr. Casuto made are extremely important. If we're really talking about what kills young people, we look at accidents, we look at homicides, and then we look at suicides. And for many of our segments of our population, suicide is a very common, perhaps the most common cause that follows perhaps only accidents. So we're talking about really the major issue that leads to really early termination of a life. And this is why it's really, it's more than just a psychiatry or a psychology or community mental health problem. This is a community health problem that really needs to be, we need to raise a level of alertness among everyone, whether it's educators, families, coaches, whatever it might be, because these are people that oftentimes are showing some signs when people look in retrospect, that if oftentimes if we get them attention early enough, perhaps we can stop it.
We go now to a call from Lisa in Finneytown. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
What is your question?
Yeah, I have a child who's been on antidepressants since he was 10, and I was kind of concerned about the long-term effects of the medication on the developing brain.
How old is he now?
13.
13. Dr. Sorter?
Sure. First of all, many of the antidepressants that have been utilized in young people have been tested relatively well. The short-term side effects seem to be minimal. And again, it depends on specifically what antidepressant is being used. There are several now FDA-approved antidepressants to treat depression in adolescents. The question raised regarding long-term use, at this point, it's clinical impressions. We don't have long-term studies to say use over a 10-year period leads to this problem. At this point, there's nothing indicating that long-term use of these medications change, ultimately, in a negative way, development. What we oftentimes do is really ask, is the medicine still necessary? We don't want young people on medicine that they don't need anymore. So from a clinical perspective, is we oftentimes, if someone has an episode of major depression, if it's treated successfully with an antidepressant, is really look after a period of 1 year to begin discontinuing the medicine and see if they still require it.
So do you think she should talk to her doctor then about a child who's been on it for 3 years?
Yes.
Lisa, does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for your call. Again, our number is 513-419-7100. Kim says, if a child is on medication for ADHD, what are the odds they will have to continue the meds into adulthood? Dr. Cossutta?
Well, you know, a lot of children do ultimately, as their frontal lobe develops, outgrow the need for stimulant medication. And I think that's why it reemphasizes the point that Dr. Sorter make, that once in a while it makes sense to try to taper medications and make sure that they're still needed. So a percentage of people grow out of their ADHD symptoms, a percentage continue to need medications in an ongoing way.
Debbie, do you find, what do you see with the children that you deal with?
And with regard to ADHD, I mm-hmm. think that's true, that we see some kids that we saw as when they were smaller children requiring medication. And I know our medical director has the same philosophy that Dr. Sorter just stated, in terms that you would prescribe a medication and then at certain intervals try to taper off and see if that medication is still needed, the idea being the least the best.
513-419-7100. Matt's on the line now from Cincinnati, and you are an adult, but you had ADHD as a kid. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was basically tested when I was in fourth grade, and the test results basically came back that the doctor said, you know, you can kind of go either way with him, to my parents, and they decided not to medicate me. Fast forward till I was, and I, you know, had some troubles in school and, you know, so on and so forth, but I was basically was a functional member of society. Fast forward till I'm 28 and just, you know, kind of got to a point in life where I realized, you know, some things were continuing to not work. And so I actually started to look at, you know, started trying to investigate what was going on, and ended up coming back to the ADHD thing. And, you know, and was diagnosed as an adult. And the couple of comments I wanted to make about kind of my life experience in this area is that, you know, and I am on medication now, fairly minimal medication. I was, you know, I graduated from college. I ran a business. Like, I've been, you know, I was reasonably successful without it. But the medication does make a difference in my life. It's just, it just clears out keeps my head a little bit more clear. So that's one point I wanted to make. Second point I wanted to make is that a lot of realizing I had ADD, aside from the medication, was having, you know, realizing that there were so many sources of information to go to for ways to cope with the ADD besides the medication. And there are lots of them, you know, or in addition to the medication, I should say. And there are a lot of resources that, you know, just as far as how I plan my life and how I structure my time, that, you know, is that I've been able to think about and be more conscious about those, about how I structure my life, given, you know, that I have ADD.
Matt,
and then, yep.
I was going to say, thank you so much for sharing. Did you have one more point you wanted to make?
Yeah, just, and I know I'm talking. I'll end it quickly. The third point I wanted to make is that I think it all exists on a spectrum, and that you know there are many people who kind of walk that line of being in between, and a lot of the people who are not diagnosed. Are at, like, I was self-medicating heavily before I got on medication with, you know, I was drinking 9 to 10 cups of coffee a day. And that was one of, realizing that probably wasn't healthy was one of the things that moved me towards medication. So, and that's my two bits. So I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks so much, Matt. We appreciate it. And we appreciate you joining us this afternoon as we're talking about mental illness on Cincinnati Edition. We'd like to hear from you as well. You can call us at 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking about mental illness in children, how to detect it and treat it. My guests are Lindner Center of Hope staff psychiatrist Dr. Leah Casuto, clinical director of psychiatry at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center Dr. Michael Sorter, and director of mental health for the Children's Home of Cincinnati Debbie Gingrich. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Email us, talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Before the break, we heard from a 28-year-old who said he suffered from ADD or ADHD as a young child, was not medicated for it, decided to go on some prescription medications after that. We also heard earlier from someone who talked about how long a person should be on medication. And Dr. Casuto, you had some comments you wanted to make.
Yeah, we had mentioned earlier that it does make sense with children after they've been on medication to taper on occasion to see if they still need the medication, but this should be done under the direction of a physician, in part because there needs to take place a risk versus benefit discussion, because these mental illnesses and problems often have dangers in and of their own. You know, for example, depression, you know, can lead to dementia if untreated. We think possibly ADHD untreated can lead to chemical dependency problems or legal issues, and kids are at risk of car accidents if they're untreated when they have ADHD.
Do you want to follow up, Dr. Casuto?
Well, I think the issue oftentimes comes down to a quality of life discussion, and the earlier callers had talked about side effects, and there oftentimes is my quality of life better with the treatment or without? And we can do that all on our own. I think Dr. Casuto's point of doing that really with someone who has knowledge about the illness, the course of the illness, the medications involved is always very important. It seemed like that caller realized that quality of life was better with reengaging with treatment. And so that's really the point of discussion to have. There are risks and benefits both for being on the medicine, I think very clearly for going off. And these are illnesses that have a course. They can have negative outcomes, and one needs to be knowledgeable before making such a move.
We go now to Victor from Camp Washington. Hi, Victor.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I've been a mental health professional for over 20 years, and most of my career I've spent training people, teaching people about mental illness, and my audiences have ranged from librarians to prison chaplains to group home operators. the largest group being law enforcement officers. I teach crisis intervention. And yet the one group that have probably the greatest impact on our children, who start meeting them when they're 5 years old and all the way up until the time they're 21 or 22, are teachers. And I've learned that, to the best of my knowledge, that teachers get little or no education about mental illness. And yet they could be the ones to recognize early signs. And I'm just wondering if your panel would comment on that.
Debbie?
We work with a lot of teachers across Hamilton County and actually have established a lot of partnerships where we have a therapist at the school up to full time. So we have a therapist available at the school to see kids. And part of their role, too, and actually part of my role as director of mental health services, is to provide the type of training and education that you're speaking about. So it's not uncommon that we would do a brief in-service during a teacher-staff meeting on how to identify signs of trauma or ADHD or depression in youth. For example, there was a school last year that had a series of student tragedies, and so we came in and did a series, an educational series for the staff on how to talk with the kids about the their grief reaction, and then when to identify a student needed more help than just kind of talking to somebody.
Victor, thanks for your call.
Well, yeah. I just wanted to make one comment, and sure. That is, I think that's awesome, but I'm just wondering if it wouldn't also be helpful to make it part of their college curriculum.
Hmm. Well, I think the point is well taken. These are individuals that are working with children from a very young age and really through their whole point of development, and oftentimes see them in a different context than their parents. There are many initiatives, and actually the school-based health initiatives that Children's Home is part of and some of the other community mental health centers are really a national model. There's been some very significant accomplishments mm-hmm. that have been done with these, putting actually providers in the schools. It makes it much easier for referrals when teachers are suspicious of a problem. Actually, mental health services can be delivered on site. And it always has a representative there who's speaking up and advocating for us being more wary, more aware of mental health issues. The idea of really it being part of a college curriculum, from my biased perspective, I would agree with wholeheartedly, and that we really need to elevate this issue because in some ways, if we just talk about a basic safety issue, this is the issue we can prevent. This, as much as it is bike helmets or even other things that we advocate for, this issue about detecting kids who are at risk is very important, and we can do a much better job with it.
Thanks so much, Great. Victor. We appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Our phone number is 513-419-7100. We now go to Sharon from Springboro. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. What's your question?
Well, I had a question. I'd like to address this shortage of psychiatrists that are available to help our kids. My situation is I have a son who's 12 who has autism. He was diagnosed out of state, and we've done a lot of therapy at home and such, and now he's hitting puberty. And so I went to my doctor to get a referral, and I'm in a 1 year into an 18-month waiting period just to get into Cincinnati Children's. He doesn't need diagnosed. He just needs to see a psychiatrist. So I'd like to see, is that just specific to autism, or is that throughout?
Is the wait always that long?
Well, typically not that long. And there may be a little bit of a difference between an assessment by a developmental pediatrician and also a child psychiatrist. Waiting lists are a problem. Currently, I think they're ranging about 40 days for a child psychiatrist. Developmental pediatricians are even shorter supply than child psychiatry is, so that's longer.
18 months sounds like a long time.
Yes, well, it's tremendous. It's a tragedy that someone has to wait that long.
Is there anything she can do to buy? I mean, does anybody have any other ideas of what she can do not to?
Well, there are certain contact numbers. I'm not sure if it would be best to go to the website or I can actually.
We do have all that on our website, WVXU.org. Right. If you click on Cincinnati Edition, you can go there. You might just tell us what.
Sure. I mean, there is the Psychiatric Intake Response Center that actually serves many of these organizations that tries to fit people in with the type of provider they need, both at Cincinnati Children's, but also at private settings and community mental health. That number is 636-4124. And that would be a number where someone could help you, hopefully plug you in a much shorter time to have your child
seen. They've already told me there's nothing they can do. So I appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay. Well, 1 second. Dr. Kasuda, is there anything you can add on what she can do in the meantime to help her child?
Well, I would say that is an awful long time to wait, and I'm wondering if what she's waiting for is actually an assessment versus treatment. Often your pediatrician can help direct you to someone they collaborate with closely. You know, and of course there's, did you have any other thoughts?
Okay, Debbie, you have any words on that?
No, I think the point of there's are very specific assessments called the ADOS scale and other similar scales that there is a much longer waiting list for.
And until you get that assessment, you can't see anyone?
That's not true. You can actually see some before that. And many people are receiving treatment even before those official scales are done.
Sharon, good luck. I hope maybe you can get something a little more quickly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Our phone number is 513-419-7100. We now go to Marie from Cincinnati. Hi, Marie.
Hi.
What's your question or comment?
Well, I have both. I'm concerned about the labeling of children from an early age, and it seems like more and more things are being labeled, like, you know, basic shyness, or if someone's going through a natural grieving process. And when I was a teacher, and this was in another state, and it was quite some time ago, but we had a classroom called the BD classroom, which stood for Behavior Disordered Classroom, and those kids would be mainstreamed into my class, and I always felt bad for them, because I knew everywhere they went, they already had this label preceding them.
What do you think I'm just going to ask what everyone thinks labeling does. I mean, it people do get labeled. Children do get labeled. Do you think this affects their ability to move forward? Debbie?
I think to some extent we have to, this goes back to one of the pros and cons discussion we had a little bit earlier. I think there is some stigma, of course, associated with labels, and that's where we have to do our best to educate people. But I think the benefit of a label is that, you know, kind of when we have just a cluster of symptoms or signs or things that are going on, we don't have a way to identify what it is that we're treating and what we're targeting. So I think in a lot of ways, those labels are developed in a response to say, I'm seeing this cluster of problems, and if I see other people that have the same kind of cluster of problems, then I can use this label to identify a group of symptoms that come together to help us understand better what we're dealing with and ultimately how to then treat it. So I think, you know, similar to how we say we're identifying that someone may have major depression, using that label, yes, does come with potential stigma, but also gives us a classification system and way to then begin to approach treatment.
I think the comments made are right on target that, for instance, autism spectrum disorder, having someone be able to receive that diagnosis really entitles them to a whole array of services that really without the diagnosis cannot occur. School systems, I think, do struggle with somehow identifying children who need this extra work or extra help. But things such as IEPs or accommodation plans oftentimes follow the appropriate diagnosis being made. And so there is a balance here that we have to weigh about having children receive the services they need that oftentimes follows a diagnosis or a label versus the idea of not doing that and perhaps them not receiving the specialized services oftentimes these young people need to really thrive.
Thanks so much, Marie. We appreciate it. Sarah has emailed and says she thinks her six-year-old son is showing signs of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Where should she go first? And she wants to know if her pediatrician should be the first stop there. Dr. Kasuda?
Yeah, I think your pediatrician is always a good first stop. They have a good idea of what's developmentally appropriate, and often they have good resources and preferences where they would want to send someone for a referral. At the Lenner Center of Hope, we do have an area of expertise in OCD and an expert, Jennifer Wells, who's a social worker who's expert in treating young children with OCD.
We did have a question from someone also who wants to know specifically, and if you can do that in about 30 seconds, what the Lindner Center of Hope really does offer to people if they're interested. And we do have a link to that on our website, WVXU.org, as
right,
well.
Right. We have a lot of different services for children, outpatient services for children 2 and older, hospitalization in partnership with Cincinnati Children's for ages 12 to 17, a partial hospitalization in partnership with Cincinnati Children's for ages 12 to 17, and a CIBC house offers a comprehensive diagnostic and intensive short-term treatment for 18 and older. We're going to be starting a new program, which is very exciting news. We'll be starting expanding our CIBC unit to treat, to assess adolescents. So a comprehensive diagnostic program for adolescents will be starting next summer.
And you can get more information again on our website on the Cincinnati Edition page at WVXU.org. We go now to Ray from Harrison. Hi, Ray.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. What's your question?
Well, my question is this. I have a son that's 23 years old, and he was diagnosed bipolar. And it started like when he was around a junior in high school. And, you know, of course, you go up and down with all the different things. You think it's behavioral. You think it's just going through his high school stage. Well, anyway, eventually we was able to find out that he was bipolar. He's on medicine now, and it's helping a lot. But and of course, you know, the stress and everything that my wife and myself go through all the time with it. Even though we have, you know, a lot of better times than we've had with him, but there's still what we call like manic stages where he'll just want to either fly off the handle, or he'll want to. Instant gratification where he wants to buy something, or he'll jump from here to there.
What's your question? How do you deal with that? Or
yeah, how can I bring him down from that high? Even though I know he's on medicine, he's taking his medicine.
Dr.
But this
Sorter?
Happens periodically.
Dr. Sorter?
Yeah. This is a common problem with young people that and adults for that matter that have bipolar disorder is that oftentimes they can still have significant mood instability. And as the caller was suggesting, many times this can be manic symptoms where their mind begins to race, their thoughts happen more, just at a more rapid pace. They jump from one subject to the next, perhaps become more impulsive. What I would make sure that to go back and have this really be a very frank discussion with the provider here. Oftentimes we can make adjustments in medications to really more fully address and suppress these manic symptoms, gain more of a steady euthymic mood so that people are more predictable from day to day. Oftentimes it really does take perhaps a more aggressive approach to try to iron out these last manifestations of bipolar disorder. Also, therapy can be very important, and really having someone engage in psychotherapy to really for them to gain a heightened understanding of when they're slipping into these types of episodes and dealing with other types of perhaps non-pharmacologic ways to help them manage their mood.
Ray, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Thank you so much. We do want to talk about, and we don't really have time today, so I'm seeing a show in the future just talking about how you deal with the insurance and all of that related to this, because there are a number of people who have questions talking about the cost of treatments for mental illness and how the insurance companies code things and all of that. So maybe we can have some folks back on to talk about that in the future. If we didn't get to your questions, I'm so sorry. You can continue your discussion on Facebook. We're 91.7 WVXU on Facebook. Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thank you very much, Marianne.
We've been talking about children's mental illness. My guests were Lindner Center of Hope staff psychiatrist Dr. Leah Casuto, clinical director of psychiatry at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center Dr. Michael Sorter, and Director of Mental Health for the Children's Home of Cincinnati, Debbie Gingrich. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Bruce Ellis. Our engineering staff is Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike McInich. We also had help today from Kevin Reynolds. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.